welcome back to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the official UK Seahawkers podcast. The NFL offseason is trundling along without much, a bit of a quiet spell before the 2020 season opens up in the next 10 days or so, free agent madness and all the rest of it. To talk through all that and what's happened over the past few weeks in the NFL and Seahawks universe, especially, join myself, Stuart Court, is Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
Not so bad. Delighted to be talking about another sport as opposed to one that's dominated my thoughts for the last month or so. So it's nice to have a bit of light relief and talk about this instead.
Yeah, and also joining myself and Adam is Rob Staton once again. How are we, Rob?
Very good. You know, very keen to get on with free agency and kind of see where the Seahawks are going now, but only a few days to go.
Yeah, and after free agency, the most recent thing to happen in the NFL calendar was the scouting combine. One of the main talking points was the change to it being primetime. What did you make of that change? It was kind of weird watching 20-year-old kids run 40 yards at over here it's 1 a.m. some of the drills. Well, it's a bit of a strange move to make, isn't it?
Well, there's two things. You know, from a personal point of view, it was a horrendous change because, you know, instead of watching the combine from like 2 p.m. till 9 p.m, it was suddenly on at 9 p.m. till 4 a.m. in the morning. So doing that for 4 nights in a row nearly killed us. I don't know if I'll be able to do it again next year. It's just too much. You know, it's like staying up for a Monday night football game 4 nights in a row. From the combine itself, I thought it was a terrible choice as well, because what you ended up having is very few players actually ran the short shuttle or the three cone, which are two of the most important drills of the whole event. I mean, everybody obsesses about the 40-yard dash and they give that a lot of focus, but it's actually the agility tests, which are very, very important for a lot of positions. And what was happening is players were doing the 40, doing the drills, and then on the on-field drills. And then what would happen is by the time they were actually getting around to doing the agility test, it was like 9, 10 o'clock at night in Indianapolis, and they just said, well, I'm not doing that. You know, I wouldn't do these things at 10 o'clock at night any other time. Yeah. So I think what they have to do in a year's time, if they're going to keep it at prime time, what they need to do is structure it a little bit better. Maybe do some of these tests either on a different day or get them out of the way very early on, because there's just no information. Like, I came away from the combine I don't know enough about, you know, several players, and many of the key players didn't even do anything. You know, people like Chase, they just completely took themselves out of the combine and said, I'm not going to do it. If a player ran a good 40, they would say, that's me done, and not do anything else, because it's just so late at night. We saw players getting injured running the 40. So I just think it's the NFL is chasing the ratings and all of that, and it's not created the best scouting combine, which is mainly the reason why it's there. It's not for audiences, it's for the teams.
Yeah, for people like Chase Young, who did absolutely nothing, what is the point of going to the combine at that point? Because obviously they talk to the teams, but someone like Chase Young, who's a certified top 2, top 3 pick, is there really much point in going if you're not going to do any on-field kind of thing?
Well, each team gets 45 official interviews at the combine. So that's meetings where, I think it used to be 15 minutes, I think it's been extended to 18 now or something like that, where you get a chance to meet these players. I think from his point of view, he will have been asked by a handful of teams, you know, probably all the teams in the top 10, for example, would have requested a meeting with him. And, you know, it's worthwhile going to those. I mean, I don't know who he officially spoke to in the end, but it's a useful exercise. You know, he will have had a chance to meet with the Washington Redskins, where everybody thinks he's going to go. So that's why he would attend. There's media as well. You know, his agent will have said it's a good opportunity for him to go out there and, you know, he's going to be a brand in a few weeks' time when he's drafted probably number 2. Go out there, get your face out there, become a talking point, even if you're not going to work out. I mean, I think with Chase Young, I actually think he avoided the combine because he wasn't going to work out very well. I mean, he did a very poor Spartan performance when he was in high school. He's not a great tester. I think he's better on the field than he is as a tester. And I think he kind of pulled himself out of the combine for that reason. But there were still reasons for him to be there, mainly the media stuff and those meetings with the teams.
Adam?
Apart from, like, Jerry Jeudy announcing himself as one of my faith, or, you know, with the Star of David on perhaps becoming one, and then Trey Adams talking about the size of his appendage, I don't really get that anything has come out. Like, normally the combine is like a buzz a week after, 2 weeks after, you know, he flashed, he looks great, you know, you had John Ross running the 40, and this quarterback looks amazing, but I can't really think of any storylines that have come out from a football perspective that have been that interesting. Am I just too cut off from it, or is there anything to that?
No, I think it was the worst combine that I've covered. You know, I've done the blog since 2008, and it was one. There just, like you said, there just weren't very many headlines. A lot of the main guys didn't test, so some of the players who may well have created some of those headlines didn't give us an opportunity to talk about them because they kind of just took themselves out. A number of players either didn't run the 40 or they didn't do on-field drills. And then, like I said, at the end of the day, you kind of run through and you just had so many players that you couldn't judge them because they didn't do the short shuttle or they didn't do the bench or they didn't do the broad or the vertical jump. So you were thinking, well, this is usually you come away with all this data and all this information about players that enables you to create talking points and say, okay, this is a strong class because of this, or here's five players who might fit the Seahawks, or here's a player who not very many people are talking about, perhaps they should be. And we were just kind of left with this really underwhelming, incomplete product off the back of the combine. And now, you know, I'm paying more attention now than I ever have done on the pro days to see how players are testing to try and fill in some of the gaps that are there, because it was just such a really poorly organized and run combine. I think the teams and the players are going to kick off about it. I think the NFL needs to look at this and either just move it back to the way it was. It was like a 3% rise in ratings. What was the point of moving it? So either get it back to what it was before, or, you know, do something, give the players an incentive to work out at these ridiculous times, which means paying them essentially to do the drills. You know, if you don't do all the drills, you don't get the money, stuff like that. There has to be some way of making this, but they have to make, if they're going to do this, they've got to try and find a way to make it work better, because the combine was a waste of time, really.
Yeah, the conversation before is the same as it was after. Is it anyone who got caught your attention that had passed you by in India, or is it again just kind of the people you were circling on your board are still circled and nothing really changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was sort of one or two players maybe impressed beyond, you know, what you expected them to do. You know, Denzel Mims was an obvious one with that from Baylor, because when you watch him on tape, the question mark with him was, how fast is he? And can he get into sort of the 4.4 range to put him in kind of radar of teams in the second round? And then he goes and runs like a 4.38. And all of a sudden you say, well, you don't see that on tape, but he's a 4.38 runner. And he's going to fly up the boards now and probably go in the first round as a consequence of that. So there were little storylines like that. I thought Antoine Winfield Jr., obviously, then people will recognize that name because of his dad. I thought he had a fantastic combine. His field drills were amazing. He ran in the 4.4s, which was faster than I think many people expected. He was explosive. He just had a very complete workout there. And for me, there were some positives. You know, you could fit players in the, you know, maybe we've been thinking this player is going to be on Seattle radar. This player, we could confirm and deny certain things there. You know, we've identified what they look for in tight ends, for example, and it is the short shuttle and the three cone. And you think, you know, a player like Hunter Bryant could easily fit the Seahawks, and I think he's going to be very much on their radar. And there's other players, you know, in the offensive line. What we really found from this class is a very explosive, deep offensive line class. There's going to be loads of options for the Seahawks there. It's as thin at defensive line as everybody expected. We kind of confirmed that, but there are still like a pocket of players that could be of interest to the Seahawks, maybe in that sort of round two, round three range. And I think the other thing that, you know, Jonathan Taylor was another one. Jonathan Taylor, I think, has really pushed his stock up with the way that he performed the Wisconsin running back. But I think what we've learned about this is that I think for the Seahawks point of view, they've got two picks at the end of round two. I think that the real value in this draft is probably going to be very early. You know, so the top 20, there's going to be some value there. Then there's going to be a bit of a drop off. And I think the next pocket of value is probably going to be from about pick 45 to pick 100, when you're going to have a very deep sort of set group of players in that range. And what might be a good plan for the Seahawks is, look, people are sick of the Seahawks trading down. But it's trying to get as many picks as possible in that 45 to 100 range, because I think that's where the real meat of the draft's going to be, unless, for once, they want to trade up from 27 into the top 20 to target a specific player.
Well, let's pick up on that, because you wrote a really interesting article a couple of weeks ago about Isaiah Simmons, and you know, he is one that obviously would take an enormous amount of moving around to draft up to that number, which I presume is kind of in the 5 to 10 range. But it was an interesting article, and as you say, you know, we're so used to the Seahawks trading down. I don't think the Seahawks have used the first round pick that they've been given for the last 8 years. I think James Carpenter was the last player they picked in the actual spot they were given. We had a brief chat about it on social media, and Stu, actually, Rob said I made a great point. So in 3 years, I actually made a point of some note. That, you know, Isaiah Simmons is the kind of guy that could potentially be your defensive quarterback for the next 10-12 years, and no one would blink twice if a team moved up to get an effect their actual quarterback. So you know, what would you be comfortable doing? And, you know, is it even, it's not necessarily realistic from a Seahawks perspective, but should it be something that they consider? Because as far as I'm concerned, they lack star quality on that defense, and maybe drafting up to get one could be a way to change that.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. And, you know, there's 2 points at play here. One, they lack star talent on defense. They've got to try and find ways to acquire that. Now, free agency is going to be big for that. You know, there's a chance for them to go out, maybe add a couple of really big additions. But you don't have a bottomless pit of money. You know, it's not like you can go out and sign five defenders and all of a sudden you've got a great defense and you've solved that problem. They are going to be limited into what they can do. I think they could probably make a couple of nice splashes in free agency and get some depth. But that's really going to be it. But they perhaps need a little bit more than that. The defense is not particularly good. It's got some good players, but overall it's not a championship caliber defense. So one of the ways to get it to that level, I don't think it's going to be picking in the kind of ranges that they've been picking, that late first round, trying to find guys in the middle rounds. During this reset, they've not been able to find those stars in the way that they did between 2010 and 2012, where they were finding, you know, Hall of Fame linebackers in round two and, you know, Hall of Fame cornerbacks in round five and sensational strong safeties in round five and a legendary linebacker in round four. You know, they haven't been able to sort of hit with that same regularity. So they can either keep trying, they may well do that, or one of these is maybe you do make a bit of a bold move to go and get one of those players. And I think that's really at the heart of what this offseason needs to be for the Seahawks. I don't care how they do it. They've got to be a bit more aggressive than they have been. You know, it was understandable the last 2 years. They were resetting. They were moving veteran players on. They didn't have a lot of cap space. They had to pay Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner. They had to sort the Frank Clark situation out. You could understand why they weren't going big in free agency and doing loads in the draft. They had 4 draft picks this time last year. It's not that they could do an awful lot of things. Now they've got a hefty number of draft picks, including 3 in the first 2 rounds. They've got some cap space. I want to see this team saying, look, Russell Wilson is in his 30s now. He's in his prime years. You've got a lot of the pieces that you need to get there. You've got to the divisional round in the playoffs. You were a game away. In fact, you weren't even a game. You were an inch away from winning the NFC West, which was won by the team that actually went to the Super Bowl and was a quarter away from winning the damn thing. So you're not a mile away from actually being in contention to win a Super Bowl, but you've got to be aggressive now to try and take that next step to get over the top. And, you know, I think someone like Isaiah Simmons is just, he ticks a lot of boxes. You know, one of the things I wrote in the piece, guys, was that I've never advocated for trading up for anybody. You know, people ask every year, who's a player that we can trade up for? Is there anybody that you think the Seahawks should move up for and be aggressive for? I've always said, no, there isn't anybody. Simmons, to me, feels like somebody you could do that because he's as safe as a prospect as I think we've seen in a long time. He's mm-hmm. he's an emotional leader for Clemson. He's been incredibly productive in terms of statistics and in terms of getting to 2 national championships as a starter, winning one of them. He has got incredible length and size. He runs in the 4.3s, despite the fact he's like 10 pounds heavier than even DK Metcalf. You look at the way you could use him. Like, one of the things the Seahawks are going to have to do over the next 5 years is find a way to limit George Kittle. What better way to do it than stick Isaiah Simmons on him twice a season or 3 times a season if they play in the playoffs? You could put him in that Michael Kendricks role. You've got a more dynamic coverage player in that role, but he can also blitz, maybe offer more as a pass rusher as well. He could be a long-term feature at the will. He could be somebody you use as a really dynamic, strong safety. One of the things that Pete Carroll identified at the end of the season as something they need to improve is the perimeter run game, which they're not very good at. You know, when the Rams stretch things out, when the 49ers stretch things out, you know, this is Seattle's run defense issues are not up the gut. It's when people get out wide and mm-hmm. get to the perimeter. Now you've got a 4.38, 4.39 runner at 240 pounds sprinting around. What are you going to do when you face Kyler Murray twice a year? You know, the Seahawks did no good containing Kyler Murray at CenturyLink Field, and they couldn't contain Lamar Jackson either. Now you've got a guy who runs a 4.3 who could spy quarterbacks like that. You know, for me, it's just like, yeah, you know, the question mark with Simmons is, this is all good, but he needs a defined role. You know, eventually you're going to have to settle on a position for him. But I kind of look at it and think, well, yeah, but game to game, he could do so much for you. And, you know, for 10 of the games, he might be simply a Sam or a Will. But then when you need him to be more than that, he can be. So I actually think that, you know, he is a player that it'd be worth considering moving up for. I think it's incredible that the number 27 pick has been used in trade-ups so often. You know, the Falcons did it for Julio Jones, Kansas City for Patrick Mahomes, New Orleans for Marcus Davenport. There is a precedent there. That helps the Seahawks because they can go to teams and say, well, this is what Atlanta did, and this is what Kansas City did. And there's a framework there for trades. So it's not like you're working from a blind position of not knowing what would actually cost to get up there. You know what teams have traded up for in the past. So if they're going to be aggressive in free agency, fine, use your draft picks. If they can't be as aggressive as they want to be in free agency, I'd like to see them be quite aggressive in the draft. And Simmons is a guy that I think would be well worth targeting like that.
And also the positional stuff is part valid, but Derwin James has never been given a position, rubber stamped, and he's one of the most dominating players that the Chargers have had for the last 2 years, and one of the big reasons that they missed out on maybe the playoffs this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think he's a really good player. I don't think this is going to happen. I said that 3 times in the article. Still people were going, this is too unrealistic. I accept that things like this are always unrealistic until they happen. A year ago, Jadeveon Clowney for a third rounder and a bag of footballs was unlikely, yet it happened. Quandre Diggs for a fifth round pick, unlikely, but it happened. You see, even going back to 2013, who anticipated them trading for Percy Harvin and then signing Bennett and Averill within the space of like a fortnight? That wasn't very likely either, and yet it happened. So, I'm sort of looking at this and thinking, if there was ever a year to do it, this is kind of it. The Seahawks need to be bold in some way. I don't think it'll be acceptable for us as a fan base or for them as a front office or as a team to be sat here in a year time with the Seahawks having just lost in the divisional round again and us all kind of going, well, they didn't really address that as needs be, have another go. I think this has to be, there really has to be a statement of intent in this offseason to really get back to the Super Bowl. It's time to get back to Super Bowls, not just get to the playoffs. They've got to do it now. These next 2 or 3 years, it needs to be Russell Wilson taking on Patrick Mahomes in a Super Bowl. We need to see that. So I want to see some bold moves here.
I mean, the last one on that is that, you've got players like Bobby Wagner who are just fantastic, but all of the things that you were talking about, Simmons, the kind of thing that we've been expecting from Wagner, but age does catch up with players, and someone like a Simmons that can take some burden off Wagner, you would imagine, would be a good way to get the best out of your captain on defense.
Well, let me sort of put this to you guys. If in, let's say, we're sat here in 5 years' time doing a podcast, and the Seahawks haven't won a Super Bowl in that time, and then they've traded for Isaiah Simmons, and it hasn't worked. Will any of us be going, if only they'd have kept the 27 pick and maybe traded down to 35, that would have given them a better chance of winning? I don't think we will. But if we sit here in 5 years and they didn't really do anything in free agency and they traded down again this year and they didn't really find any superstars and the defense cost them again and they just lost it in the divisional round to whoever they happen to play from the NFC South this time or whatever, it's that to me will be a bigger issue is sort of not doing enough when the time was there to act. And I think the time now is to act, and that is to combine some bold moves in free agency and to be aggressive there to keep the play. If they want to keep Jadeveon Clowney, make sure you keep him. If there's a certain price you're not prepared to go to, then fine. But go and get a Yannick Ngakoue or go and add somebody else in free agency. And then, when you get to the draft, come out of that draft feeling like you've got some star talent, some impact talent, as opposed to, I'm not writing off last year's draft class, but it felt like a lot of the focus on that was on special teams, which is great, but the top picks apart from DK Metcalf didn't really work out. And the great thing about Metcalf is they got somebody with major upside and they gave him an opportunity and it worked. And I think just sort of Simmons could be that same kind of player on defense for them. And I don't think it sounds like I'm saying they've got to do this now, and if they don't do it, it will be unacceptable. That's not my position at all. I acknowledge it's unrealistic. I don't think it's going to happen. But I think we have a right as Seahawks fans to want and expect some nads this offseason.
It's time now. It's time to go now.
Yeah, I look, with the greatest respect to that tweet, I think we're getting to a point now where people are overthinking this, where people are looking at the cap space, which has shrunk a little bit because because they signed Greg Olsen. All of a sudden the Seahawks are not in the top 10 of cap space anymore, and that's just because other teams have cut players. Everyone's like panicking a little bit and saying, oh, what can they do? What can they do? So the Seahawks can do whatever the hell they want. You know, Frank Clark's cap hit in 2019 was $6.5 million. He's on a $21.5 million a year deal. Khalil Max was like $11 million or something like that in the first year. So just because you've signed Clowney to $21 million, let's say, as a figure there, his year one cap hit could be as low as $6-7 million if you wanted it to be. So you're not absolutely wiping out half of your cap. I think people are sort of looking at $21 million, just taking it away from the available cap space in 2020. And that's not how it works, because in a few years' time, the new CBA is going to have kicked into place. You're going to have a load of gambling money, a new TV deal playing into this. The cap's going to rise up. What we think is a decent contract now in 2 or 3 years' time is going to be completely different. So you might actually be getting real value for money on a $21 million a year deal that's backdated a little bit into 2 or 3 years' time. Plus, the other thing is you're not going to have Dwayne Brown's contract in 2 or 3 years' time. You're not going to have Justin Britt. You're not going to have KJ Wright. They may not even be on the team this year, let alone in 2 or 3 years' time. So actually, you're going to have big contracts coming off the books. So you can actually sign a couple of stars to enable you to have this bit. I mean, I'm looking at a list of free agents here. I mean, who is Jake keeps thinking that they should go after in the second and third tier? Because, you know, I'm actually looking at the players. I mean, they're just... Is it a Jason Pierre-Paul, age 32? Is it Bruce Irvin, age 33? Is it Mario Addison, age 33? I mean, are these the types of players the Seahawks should be relying on to take a step forward this year? Is that going to be acceptable to anybody in a year's time if they don't get further than the divisional round? I mean, that time has been and gone. You know, this second and third wave tier was great when they had Bennett and Averill off the edge, the LOB, Bobby Wagner and KJ at their peak, Marshawn Lynch, Doug Baldwin, Cam, you know, like that's fine. They don't have those players anymore. And the window is going to run out in 2 or 3 years' time, or it's going to be reduced. And we're all going to be sat here wondering, saying, again, they needed to do something here. So I think that's not going to be good enough. And look, if Clowney gets offered $25 million a year next year, they probably are going to move on. But then it's going to be on them to go and sign somebody else. And you know, it might be that they go and sign Dante Fowler or Arik Armstead, or Everson Griffin, or they go and trade for Yannick Ngakoue, or listen, they could pull out a trade out of nowhere that nobody's expecting that quenches this desire for some star talent on defense that we're not even talking about. I mean, like, unpredictable things happen with this team sometimes. So one way or another, they're going to sort this out, and they're going to get this done. I think they're fully aware. The Russell Wilson coming out saying that they need superstars, kind of just put an exclamation point on it. John Schneider said he's had sleepless nights all off-season working out how they're going to get this sorted. I get everything that they're saying is that they are men on a mission this off-season, and I don't see them resorting to cheap free agents to try and get this done. I don't think we're going to see Dad's Army rolled out with Mario Addison and Bruce Irvin and Michael Bennett to try and fix the pass rush. The defense doesn't have any speed. It needs some speed, not guys who are, you know, a year away from retiring.
Yeah, the whole free agency approach is very Southampton, where they had those few years where they just sold every player, every academy product to Arsenal, Spurs or Liverpool. But it's now seen with Southampton that the well has run dry, and it like you said, Rob, with looking at the names, the well for that impact has run dry, and so is the window almost. Back on Simmons, obviously you say he is going to be too expensive to go all that way for him, but is there anyone else in that top 15 range that would add to the defense? No. Would add all that you've said to the defense, or is it just Simmons, or just stamp out or move back?
I mean, all the other players kind of have a question mark there. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, you could say, well, what about Javon Kinlaw? But, you know, some health issues, not quite as consistent as you'd want. I've heard one or two things about the way he practices and maybe doesn't practice as much as you'd like. You know, there are certain question marks there that you think, well, I'd draft him, but I'm not trading up for him. And, you know, I think the thing with Simmons is he just ticks every box along the way. I mean, I just want to add one quick final thing on the whole offseason thing. People act like this, you know, Seahawks have a strong reputation for trading down and playing free agency and stuff like that. I think people often forget and overlook how aggressive this team has been over the years. I mean, in 2011, they signed Sidney Rice, Robert Gallery and Zach Miller in free agency and Tavares Jackson. And they re-signed Brandon Mebane all in the space of like a week. And then, you know, in 2013, they traded for Percy Harvin and gave up a first-round pick and a third-round pick, signed Bennett and Averill. You know, they've traded for Dwayne Brown mid-season. They traded for Sheldon Richardson like the week before the season, gave a second-round pick for a one-year rental. They've, you know, they've been very, very bold. Jimmy Graham trade in 2015, when they've seen they have a need to fill, they have gone after it with the vigor of that any fan base would want their team to go after. And not all of those moves have worked out, but you can't, you know, you understand the logic. You know, a year ago, Clowney and Ziggy Ansah as bookend pass rushers. Yeah, that sounded great. Mm. It didn't work out, but the plan was there. And a first round pick to go into the mix as well, into the rotation. It didn't work out, but the plan made sense. And I think whatever they come up with this offseason will be, one, aggressive, and two, will make sense. Whether it actually works out or not, we'll have to wait and see when the football starts in September. But the plan will make sense, and I think they are going to be aggressive. I don't think they're going to be timid. I don't think they're just going to dip the toe in the water and go, oh, we'll play it safe. I think they're going to get after this. They're not going to be irresponsible, but they're going to get after it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, Greg Olsen is a move that they have made, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that. It's, you know, one that seems that the number, you know, 7 million sounds like a high number. 5.5 million, I think, is the cap hit. But you know, I look at a team that sometimes there's not. I've always wanted a player that, you know, can just be relied on for a quick 5 yard gain, because it's kind of thing that I feel like we're lacking. It's either a scramble or it's a deep ball or there's a run, but someone like that that can be another safety blanket for Wilson. Although, you know, their age is not on his side, I'm fairly pro that signing, I have to say.
Yeah, I agree. And look, it's 1 year deal. You know, if it was 7 million a year for 3 years, it'd be different. I mean, it's 1 year deal. He's going to, you know, they've put a big emphasis on fit and culture and getting the right kind of guys in the locker room. And that's what Greg Olsen's going to do. They needed to sign a tight end. You know, it was an absolutely vital signing. They couldn't go into the new season relying on Will Dissly. We'd all love for them to be able to rely on Will Dissly, but he's had two serious injuries in back-to-back years. So they needed to do something there. And the options were, you sign Greg Olsen for 1 year, and in a year's time, he's off the books and he's probably in a broadcasting booth somewhere. Or you sign Austin Hooper for 12 million a year. If you sign Austin Hooper for 10 to 12 million a year, he's your tight end for the future. It ain't Will Dissly. Mm. The good thing about this deal is it gives Will Dissly every opportunity to come back in 2020, get back to health, have a good season, and warrant the faith of being the tight end for the next 2, 3, 4 years. You're not writing him off. If you sign Austin Hooper for 10, he's your tight end. Will Dissly is just a number two that you probably let it, you know, you sign, either re-sign him on a modest deal or he moves on after his 4-year contract runs out. And I think the other thing with this position is, I think it's actually sneakily one that they're putting a lot of emphasis on. So I think they are, it's not a good tight end draft. I think that the trade for Jacob Hollister is something to remember here. They came out of the draft last year having not drafted a tight end and immediately traded for Hollister because they wanted that skill set. They wanted to move tight end to complement Ed Dixon and Will Dissly to play the other side, to be a big slot, to get third down conversions and probably be a red zone threat. And I think that it's going to cost $2 million probably to keep Hollister on a tender. And I think rather than do that, they may well have a sneaky look at Hunter Bryant here, mm-hmm. because he fits people that... You know, I wrote about this yesterday. People have lingered on Hunter Bryant's 40 time, which is 4.74, which is not fast. But look at Rob Gronkowski's 40 time. Look at Travis Kelce's 40 time. Look at Hunter Henry's 40 time. They're all in that same kind of ballpark. 40 time is massively overrated with tight ends. The thing to look at is three cone and short shuttle. They're the times that matter. And Hunter Bryant had an elite three cone time for a tight end. He's from a school that they love for tight ends, that trains their tight ends. He did do some blocking at Washington. He's got soft hands. I know he had a few drops, but I don't see that as a massive issue. It's not something that I'm worried about with Hunter Bryant. And I think he could be a dynamic playmaker. And I think if you put him alongside, whether it's Olsen or Dissly, and have him as a big slot, chain mover, he's been training with Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright this offseason. He's in tremendous shape. I think he's somebody that sneakily they might place a lot of value on, and then might say, that's where we want to take him, whether it's the second or third round. We're going to make sure we get him in this draft.
Okay, yeah, I mean, and obviously the point about Hunter Bryant is that he probably, unless I'm, you know, recency bias is taking control of me here, probably looked a better prospect as a pass-catching tight end coming out of Washington than even Will Dissly did at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, that's the thing, is that Dissly has looked really good. as a pass catching tight end. You know, he was brought in for his blocking, but actually has done a really good job as a receiver as well. And it kind of just underlines the point with him. And like, again, look, I've got the numbers here. So Hunter Bryant ran a 4.74. Jordan Reed, I think we'd all accept has had a decent, you know, concussions have been an issue with Jordan Reed, but he's been a dynamic weapon, hasn't he, at tight end for the Redskins until he was cut this year. He ran a 4.72. It's practically the same time as Hunter Bryant. Will Disley ran a 4.87. Does he look really slow? I mean, not to me. Travis Kelce, 4.61. Zach Ertz, a 4.76. Slower than Hunter Bryant. TJ Hockenson went in the top 10 last year. He ran a 4.70. It's practically the same time as Hunter Bryant. What's the one trait that all of these players have? Rob Gronkowski ran a 4.68. It's practically the same as Hunter Bryant. What do they all have? Amazing three-cone times. Gronkowski, Henry, Hockenson, Ertz, Kelce, Disley all ran really good three-cone times. It's that sort of short area, change of direction, that quickness, that ability to sort of find a mismatch, create that easy separation on a shorter route or down the seam, which is showing up with the three-cone times. Hunter Bryant ran an excellent 7.08 three-cone. And I think some teams might overlook him a little bit because of the 4.74. I think there's some values we have there. And I think if you actually put him on the field in a two tight end set, and you've got DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett outside, and you've got him as your big slot, and you've got a Disley or an Olsen out there, that to me looks perfect for Russell Wilson. He's got so many options that he could go, so many different skill sets. He's got the deep option. He's got Lockett can go deep, but he can cut inside. You know, Metcalf can be brilliant on crossing routes. You've got a big slot who can go down the seam and attack the seam downfield, but can settle in and find a little soft spot in zone. You've got Greg Olsen who can be blocking, and Disley can be blocking, but they could also run around. So I think there's a lot of options there for the Seahawks if they were to get someone like Hunter Bryant. And I've just, you know, again, I think that he is somebody that they could really target. And look, I'm not trying to read too much into this, but when the combine started, the first day of the combine, they immediately flicked up to the booth where John Schneider and Pete Carroll were sat, and John Schneider was busying himself with something, and Pete Carroll just sort of nudged him in the ribs and went, you want to pay attention to this 40-yard dash, and it was Hunter Bryant's. So I think there's going to be some interest there.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the receiver lineup, because obviously this draft is being heralded as one of the great receiver drafts coming out. Presumably, you know, you'd like to see the Seahawks take someone at some point, and I would imagine one of those 2 second round picks at the back end is looking like the spot that you might look to take one.
Yeah, I think possibly so. I think it would be, you know, there's sort of three options for the Seahawks here. Either one of the top receivers is going to last to where they pick in the first round and could be an option for them there, you know, and then the type of players you're talking about there, Brandon Ayuk, KJ Hamler, Jalen Reagor, Justin Jefferson, Denzel Mims, you know, it's one of those types of players. Then the second option is that, you know, you get to either you trade down into round two and one of those guys is still there, or you're looking at the back end of round two and you might be looking at Van Jefferson, or you might be looking at, you know, someone like Bryan Edwards, who's not been tested because he's broken his foot in combine training, but looks a lot like a Seahawks type receiver. And then if, you know, at the back end of round two, if the options aren't there, a lot of guys are running in the 4.4s in this draft class. That is the range where the Seahawks like to take their receivers. They'll find somebody in round four, like they always do at the receiver position, and they will take them there as well. So I think with the tight end thing, it's about getting that big slot, that, an upgrade. Jacob Hollis did a good job, but if you can upgrade that position, then great. If not, they can bring back Jacob Hollis on a cheap deal, probably after the draft. And then I think with the receiver position, it's getting another speedy, dynamic receiver that can, you know, that speed threat, downfield threat, somebody who can work in the slot and really complement everything else that you've already got. You know, I don't think they need a big target. They've got one of those in DK Metcalf. They've got the tight end. I think they need another really speedy, dynamic receiver, and I think they'll get one.
I just kind of like celebrated quietly to myself when you mentioned Bryan Edwards, because I watched quite a lot of South Carolina and he was the only out that quarterback had last year until he got injured at the back end, and I'd say he's broke his foot. But yeah, I'd love, and Jalen Reagor, who I've been, I think I mentioned him to you, Adam, about over a year ago, is at TCU.
Brilliant. You know, Reagor is fantastic. His vertical jump is unbelievable. He outjumps guys in the red zone who were like, you know, 6'2". And he's like 5'9", 5'10".
Yeah. On Reagor, obviously the recent history with TCU, Josh Jackson came out of TCU. It's a bit silly to do it, I guess, but would teams look at the players that have come out of that school and kind of not panned out. Would that be something that the teams consider when they're looking at Origi, who's coming from school where the last receiver heralded like he is, was Doxon, who is out of the league within 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's certain schools have certain reputations, like Florida State's like pass rushers. And like with other schools, you know, it's players who show a lot in college but then don't actually take the next step. And, you know, I don't think TCU have warranted that reputation at right receiver just because of Josh Doxon. I mean, I was never a big fan of his, to be personally honest, anyway. I didn't think he was a first-round pick and thought that was a bit of a reach. But with Rieger, I think, you know, what such a dynamic player, can get downfield, can do all of that, can take the top of a defense. And he's so explosive, like jumped a 42-inch vertical, and that showed up time and time again on tape. You know, throw the ball up to him in the red zone, he'll go up and get it, high point the football, get over guys, he's got the speed to get downfield. Yeah, he ran a 4.47, he'd added too much muscle to go into the combine, to look a bit bigger, to look a bit more like Deebo Samuel. I think he will lose a bit of that weight and get back into that 4.40, 4.3 range. I think he's a really great option for the Seahawks then. Brian Edwards is one of my favourite players in the draft. Really like him, you know, great yards after the catch, can get downfield. I think great personality, kind of fits what the Seahawks look for at that. I think he's sort of in between. He's not big like DK Metcalf, he's not small like Tyler Lockett. He could be sort of that nice third option that they've got there. I think he could definitely be on their radar, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if they target him at the end of round two.
On the offensive side of the ball, last year we saw Jakai Pollard come out of Florida and he flamed up the boards and flamed out the league for numerous reasons. But there's two guys, edge guys, come out of Florida this year. You've profiled a little bit on your blog. Do you want to talk about them quickly?
Yeah, so the thing about Polite was I think that was all self-inflicted rather than, you know, being any connection to Florida, because he was a good player. I just, you know, whatever he was doing before the combine and since. I heard a story about him when he was drafted by the Jets. Like, he was like arguing with somebody or something. But anyway, it's no surprise he's in about the league after 1 year. I think with the two other Florida guys, first of all, Jonathan Grenard is one of the ultimate guys you want to root for. He's just like he's a mature guy, alpha male. His interviews are outstanding, team leader. The problem with him is he's not very fast. And you watch him on the tape and you can kind of see that. And there was an anticipation that he was going to run 4.8s, 4.9s at the combine, and he ran a 4.87. So that wasn't a surprise at all. But don't write him off too soon, because the one thing he did do very well, short shuttle, three cone. Again, the agility tests, so important, especially for the Seahawks and pass rushers. They've often targeted people who run well in those two agility drills on the defensive line. Now, he ran a 4.34 short shuttle at 263 pounds, which is kind of in the ballpark for people like Rasheem Green and Sam Hubbard, who they apparently liked as well a couple of years ago. He has 35-inch arms, despite the fact he's 6'3". So he's got, you know, vines for arms, great agility, good production at Florida, great character. He's the kind of player, because of his speed, that could last around three. And I think in that kind of range, it's worth taking a chance on him. Now, he's had a very serious wrist injury, and he transferred from Louisville to Florida after graduating. He left Louisville purely because Bobby Petrino was the coach who recruited him, left, went to Florida, became a team leader. I think in the first meet, it was a bit of a Russell Wilson-esque story. Kind of first team meeting, he stood up and gave a speech and became the team leader straight away. But he's got a wrist injury, which he doesn't use his right hand as much as he should when he engages. And that's something they're going to have to get into his head. Is it still causing him pain? Is it a mental thing? Can he get over that? Because that is going to be, you need to be able to use your hands in the NFL. So that's something to think about with him. But I think he's a good player. And I think that the agility testing could get him on Seattle's radar. Jabari Zuniga is a much faster, twitchier kind of player. Same weight, doesn't have the length. He's got just a shade under 33-inch arms. Ran a 4.64, didn't do any of the agility testing like a lot of players. But he has got a little bit of burst off the edge, good with his hands. Didn't have a great senior bowl, but looked terrific at the combine. Just really well put together. And again, a player that, because he had a few injuries in 2019, might just last a little bit longer than he would have done a year ago. And the year he was kind of like a top 45 a year ago, he didn't declare. I think now he's possibly round two, round three. But I think he and Grenard are two players that Seahawks are probably not going to be able to get a pass rusher with their first pick unless it's Julian Aquara. But I think that Grenard and Zuniga are a couple of players that if they traded back from round two into round three, they could be players that could definitely be on the radar and could add to the rotation that they're looking for.
And just looking kind of back into the draft a little bit further, we all have a little nugget in round six or seven. Are there any guys that you've got your eye on that you can kind of, you want to talk, like when in the chefing world, we have wild garlic. When you know where there's a wild garlic plant, you know where it is, but you don't tell anyone about it because you don't want them to nick it. Is there anything that's kind of like that for you in kind of round six or seven with a player that you almost don't want to get too much pop because you're quite high on him?
I mean, I don't know if they'll go in round six or seven because you just never know. You know, they might end up going a little bit earlier than this. But there's a few players that I've looked at that I quite like that could be sort of later on. Josh Metellus is somebody at Michigan who is a real hard-nosed safety, loves a tackle. You know, the Seahawks tackling was really poor a year ago or last season, and he doesn't miss a lot of tackles, finishes very well in that regard. Kind of a bit of a cocky attitude, but not over the top. Very serious individual. They like the Michigan guys, so I think he's somebody that could come in and have a bit of a role there. I don't know how. I mean, like Hakeem Adeniji is somebody who gets talked up an awful lot as a player that you could see him going in sort of the middle rounds, or you could see him going later on. I really like him. I thought he was fantastic at the Senior Bowl. He's got tackle and guard experience. He's snapped in practice. He's a guard from Kansas. You know, I think that he is a player that, you know, if it was round three, I'd take him. But if he lasts a bit longer than that, fair enough. Devon Hamilton at Ohio State, kind of big, plugging defensive tackle, very explosive. Could be somebody to keep an eye on there. I'm kind of just running through my list here to see if there's any other names I could throw your way. Alex Taylor.
Do you think they'll take another visit to the island and draft the quarterback, Cole McDonald? Because he seems to be some. Well, I was watching elsewhere last year after they drafted him. He popped quite a bit. Actually, someone who has like an in with the league kind of thing. Cole McDonald seems to be that kind of late round Alex Magoo type flyer that they could take at the quarterback position, because obviously Geno Smith is a free agent and they didn't really pay much effort to keep Brett Hundley last year. Do you think Cole McDonald will be someone they look at?
I mean, I've not studied him, so I can't really offer an opinion on him too much, but I think the quarterback position, it's going to be interesting because they've kind of stayed away from it, and you kind of think, well, why would they do it now? You know, a year from after paying Russell Wilson, unless there was somebody they really, really liked and they felt like we've got to save some money there, to me, you're probably looking later rounds. I mean, look, I think they'll really like Jalen Hurts. If they could get it, you know, I think before his combine and, you know, his kind of stocks, you know, gone right up again, if he'd have been there in sort of like round four or five, then I think that they could have easily have taken him, you know, his leadership, his quality, you know, his physical ability, the fact that he's sort of a similar style to Russell Wilson, his mobility. I think they could have taken him and looked at, you know, a quality backup there with some trade value down the line. He's probably going to go round two, round three now, the way that his offseason is trending that way. I think Steven Montez is somebody they might look at. You know, he had a fantastic pro day today for Colorado. He's got all the tools, very mobile, just very inconsistent. Could be somebody they look at. You know, they've looked at taller quarterbacks in the past as well. You know, they're not just looking for, let's say, Russell Wilson types. So, the quarterback, there's a couple of options there. You know, are they going to go down that road? I mean, they've only drafted two quarterbacks, haven't they? You know, in a decade. So, you know, it's always quite difficult to sort of find the guy that they might go after. We have to wait and see if they meet any of these guys. I think the VMAC visits are obviously going to be a tell there. If any smaller school quarterbacks come in, then obviously that puts them on the radar.
Hello.
In terms of quarterbacks at the top of the draft, you know, Burrow and Tua are the guys that are getting the main pop. And, you know, it's always interesting to talk about the guys that are going to go nice and early. Burrow just, unless I'm missing something, oh, yeah, and there's red flags that I'm not seeing, I just seem to like everything that he does. He reminds me of what I imagine someone almost like a Namath would have looked like coming out of college. Like, he's just, the way he carries himself, everything just looks very correct about him, and a guy that if he was on my team I'd be excited to root for. Is that a fair assessment, or am I maybe just, you know, letting his LSU record shroud my view on that?
Oh, I think he's an incredibly exciting player, you know, one of the best that has come into the league at the quarterback position in certainly in the recent history. Just everything about him is star talent, you know. Is I just love his self-confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of cocky, but it is a little bit irritating, but in a likable way, if that makes any sense. You kind of like, it doesn't bother you, you kind of like the fact that he's got this real self-confidence about him, and it shows on the field in his interviews. It's almost like, yeah, do you know what? I was born to be on this spotlight. Bring it on. It's that kind of thing. Nothing's going to intimidate me, you know. And I kind of like that about it. He's got some balls, you know. I like that about it. Yeah, I think it is. I think it's even, it's like a, it's that on steroids, really. It's kind of, he sticks his chest out, gets out there, you know, no, I'm not sliding, you know, I'm going to run and I'm going to take a hit. You know, it's that kind of thing. He's probably going to have to do something about that at the next level. But, you know, his accuracy, his improvise, you know, what you want to see from a quarterback, improvisation these days. They've got to be able to scramble away from pressure, extend plays, keep their eyes downfield. All the top quarterbacks do it. Russell, Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes. Yeah, that's what quarterbacks have to do these days. Defensive lines are too good. They have to get away from pressure and throw downfield. He does that. He makes the impossible possible. He can play on time. He is very accurate. His ball placement, unbelievable. He's got the height. He's not got a rocket arm. He's not Mahomes in that regard, but he's got a decent enough arm and you can always work on arm strength, you know. So I think he is a fantastic player. I kind of fear for him a little bit that he's stuck with the Bengals, and you know what they, you know, that team in Cincinnati, they were bad some years, but then they were playoff contenders others with that cast of characters, and then Marvin Lewis moves on and the new coaching staff come in and they're instantly the worst team in the league, and without meaning to be, like the Miami Dolphins were setting themselves up to be the worst team in the league for a year before the 2019 season. The Bengals stumbled into being the worst team in the league. And I just worry for him that he's going into a lousy franchise that's not properly set up, that's not a professionally run team. It's like a family business and has got a coaching staff that are out of their depth. I think if he was going to possibly the Panthers with their new regime, or he was going to, you know, some of these other teams that are... It's hard to sort of pick one off the top of my head right now. If he was going to a proper team, then you could say, yeah, you know what? He's got a great chance to succeed. The Bengals may not be the best match for him, but that's where he's going to end up going. And it's going to be fascinating to see how he does. But I just think, what a player. Unbelievable LSU. Definite, surefire, best player in the draft and number one pick.
Yeah, I love watching. But also, people have been pointing out his record against, obviously, LSU when... Was it five or six games they won last this year against teams in the top 10? And obviously they went then sealed it with the national championship, national title as well, which obviously that is a big thing when that big game, you don't kind of shrink into the background. He kind of stepped up and stepped up massively. Is there anything the Seahawks do or don't do next weekend when free agency kicks off with the tampering period or whatever it's called? That isn't going to affect what they do at the end of April that much, is it? Obviously, it looks like a Fed is probably going to be too expensive with the money being thrown around. Jaron Reed is somewhat more up in the air as well, but it's whatever they do with those two names, and obviously then Clowney as well, it's not going to change their plans too much, is it, do you think? Or
yeah, I think it will. I actually think it will influence everything. You know, if they don't get the pass rush sorted, then if they're going into the draft and they don't feel confident about that, then it is probably going to dictate what they do. And look, we've seen the Seahawks in the past, if they've got a huge need still remaining in the draft, they'll find a way to fill that need. You know, they'll trade their way into a position where they can get the guy that fills the need. So, you know, I think if pass rush hasn't been sorted, you probably are looking at a Julian Aquara with their first pick, you know, just sort of manipulating the board to get themselves into that position, or one of these other pass rushers in order to do that. The first priority is obviously Jadeveon Clowney, and it's getting that. If he moves on for ridiculous money elsewhere, then they've got to go and get a different pass rusher. And you know, Pete's spoken very directly to John Clayton about they want a five technique and they want a Leo. So they're the two positions, and Clowney would be the five technique. Then they're still going to go and get a Leo. And whether that, if they sign Clowney for big money, they're probably going to get a cheaper Leo, something like Everson Griffin, maybe Dante Fowler, you know, somebody in that kind of range. If Clowney moves on, maybe they move on to Arik Armstead. He might be plan B at five technique, and then they go and get somebody else to play the Leo there. But they're going to get those two positions sorted. Jaron Reed, Pete Carroll and John Schneider have both made it very, very clear that they really want Jaron Reed to stay. And if Jaron Reed's money is 10 to 12 million, I think there's a very good chance that he will be back with the Seahawks. I think they really like his fit and his leadership, and they wanted him back. So I think there's actually probably a better chance of him coming back than people are currently projecting. And if Clowney moves, I think that he will definitely stay. I think they will just take some of that money and give it to Jeremy, and they'll be able to structure that. And then if so, they say they do that, so they get the Leo and the Five Tinnig and Jaron Reed sorted, then what that means is you've got to set yourself up for the draft. And what I mean by setting yourself up for the draft is you've got to sign a right tackle as a draft hedge, because you cannot go into the draft with nothing at right tackle, because you're going to see Fanton and Fedimudor. So that means getting a veteran who is not expensive, who can compete to start if the draft doesn't work out the way that you intended. So it could be Jared Veldheer, who was at Green Bay. It could be Darrell Williams, who was at Carolina, a player like that. And then you go into the draft with the intention of probably taking an offensive tackle with your first pick. And someone like Isaiah Wilson, who I like a lot, could be a Prince Tega Wanogo. It could be a Lucas Niang. It could be, you know, Ezra Cleveland. I don't think Austin Jackson's going to be there anymore after the way that he tested the combine. But they're the kind of players that you are talking about there. Or if those players are off the board, a couple of rounds later, a Matt Piat, somebody like that who's played right tackle at Connecticut. So they've got some options in the draft class to go and do that. But it's about set yourself up in free agency to go and do that. I can't imagine a scenario where the pass rush and the offensive line are all done going into the draft, which would enable them to take a bit of a luxury pick like a Jonathan Taylor, who has been basically begging the Seahawks to draft him at the combine, or you know, some of these safeties or something like that. I don't think they'll be able to have the luxury to do that. But with three picks in the first couple of rounds, you know, they can add some guys that they like. And I think if they get the pass rush sorted in free agency, they can manipulate the board as they often do and come away with, you know, three players who are Seahawks, in quote marks, and they'll feel pretty good about it.
So for you, what, 6-7 weeks out from the draft, if Clowney stays, it's Wilson from Georgia, but if he leaves, it's Okwara, yeah?
Possibly. I mean, yeah. You know, I think that's a... Those are two good examples. I mean, Wilson might not get past Minnesota at 25. They drafted Phil Loadhole in round two. So they like these big guys. Wilson just looks like he's built like a Terminator. So, I think he would interest the Seahawks a lot if he was there at 27, or they might do like trade down a couple of places and still draft him if he was still there. If they don't sort the pass rush out, then they're kind of handcuffed. They're going to have to do that. You know, look, the Seahawks were held back last year because of the pass rush. Mm-hmm. They had a top five offense in DVOA. The reason they couldn't do more than they did is because the defense wasn't good enough. So it's just common sense that if they're going to do better this year, the defense has to be better. So one way or another, that defense has to get better. And if they don't sort that out in free agency, then they have to do it in the draft. I think they will do, because of the strength of the draft is receiver and offensive line, I think they will sort the pass rush out in the free agency. They've already sorted the tight end position with Greg Olsen, and they will go into this draft thinking, right, let's go for it. Offensive line, receivers, maybe Hunter Bryant. Go and get our guys.
You seem much more bullish this time around than the last couple of years when we've spoken, which I think the three of us have generally been agreed that, you know, it's a rebuild, and you know, doing as well as they have done is something to be praised quite considerably, given what a lot of other teams do when they're in their rebuild. But this time speaking, it seems like you feel like, you know, this is, you know, we've had the couple of years now, and we've got these players in their peak, and now it's time to push on, and there's going to be fewer excuses allowed going into next year.
Absolutely, 100% nailed that. I mean, that, you know, 2 years ago, I thought 9-7 and it was 10-6. Mm-hmm. And then last year, I thought 10-6 and it was 11-5. So, you know, two fairly modest projections there. You could see the team had holes, but you couldn't. I thought patience was required. I think you guys probably felt the same way. I know a lot of Seahawks fans probably thought, oh, they've got to go and do a bit more. But I thought it was understandable that they were resetting. They had to get the cap sorted. They didn't have a lot of draft picks a year ago. And now they're in the position where now is the time. Now, I will not be bullish in 6 months if they have not done the kind of things that we're talking about in this podcast and have really gone after it. If they've done what Jake Heaps is saying in the tweet, we're kind of thinking, well, I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure whether the pass rush has been solved. And I'm not sure that they have got speed on defense. And I'm not sure that they have added some stars. And I'm not sure that they are any better than they were a year ago. Then I won't be bullish, and neither will you. And we'll probably be sitting there saying it's probably going to be another 10-6, second in the NFC West, knocked out in the wild card or the divisional round. But I've got faith in this team. I, you know, they are not Pete Carroll's nearly 70 years old. Mm. He's not hanging about. He's not playing the long game here. Russell Wilson certainly isn't, because he's already told them to go and get some stars. You know, Russell's in his 30s now. You know, it's now is the time. And if they come out of this offseason having had a really bold draft and free agency period, then everybody's going to be excited. You know, everybody's going to be feeling this is a chance to go from an 11-win team that was an inch away from being a 12-win team and a division champ to a team that could win 13 or 14 games next year. I mean, the Seahawks probably won't, because they somehow find a way to get in their own way too often. They don't do what the Ravens did a year ago and kind of just get through the schedule. But you know, they've got a great chance. There's an opportunity there this offseason. They've just got to deliver now, and it starts next Monday with what they're doing free agency. I have confidence that they're gonna put themselves in there, and that's why I feel bullish about it. But they've got to get it done now. You know, it's all well and good as talking about it and then believing in it. They've got to do it.
Well, I guess that's the difference this year versus the last two, that for the first offseason in a few years, they can address it. There's no need to be patient and look forward to next year. So I think when you say, you know, in 6 months' time, if they've not done it, we'd probably have a bit of a right to be a bit frustrated, certainly more so than we were this time last year.
Yeah, and you know what? When the season starts, we'll all be saying, you know, go for it, and hoping that, you know, whatever they've done will work, even if we are a bit frustrated by it in June time, that they haven't done as much as we were hoping. But I think they will. And look, whether it's Clowney or Ngakoue or Von Miller or Calais Campbell or Chris Jones or whatever it is that they do this offseason, or, you know, they're going to do something. They're going to make a splash. It's the Seahawks. Mm. Whenever they've had a chance to do something interesting, they do it. They're the most interesting team in the league when it comes to making deals and getting things done and making headlines. You know, they're never dull. You know, they've either got a mutiny in the background, or they're the best defense in the league, or, you know, they make a Clowney trade or a Harvin trade or a Graham trade, or, you know, it's just they draft a guy who looks like Batman or Batsuit, you know, to play receiver. Or, you know, it's always interesting. It's going to be interesting next week. They're not going to go quietly into the night and hope to sneak up on the Niners and the Rams and the Saints and whoever comes out of the NFC East and whoever. You know, they're going to go for it, and they have to go for it. They're in the toughest division in the league. You're not going to beat the Niners and the Rams next year by playing it safe. You've got to go for it. So they're going to go for it. I know they are. And it's just we're just going to sit back next Monday. I don't know. It's like friends. He starts like 9 o'clock at night or something.
Yeah.
You know, sit back with a beer or a cup of tea or whatever it is you drink, and you know, wait for the news to roll in. And I think it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, and also the Graham and Clowney deals happened. Well, Graham deal happened while I was had no phone at a Coventry City game, and the Clowney deal happened while I was in the Copper Box in London, which has no phone signal. So next Saturday, I'm at Sinsel Bank in Lincoln. Well, currently I'm in Sinsel Bank watching City play. So that's probably going to be the time when the Clowney deal or the massive, ridiculous one comes through.
So let me ask you, you know, what was your reaction when you heard about those deals? Because I remember the Harvin one, I was kind of like, really? And then I thought about it, because my wife was pregnant at the time. We went to the Lake District on a holiday, and she was watching Game of Thrones or something, and I was sat there doing a mock draft, and I had no idea who to put at 25. I was like, there's nobody to put there. And then like they traded for Harvin, it was like, well, that's why, because there was nobody there. And then with the Graham one, I remember I was at home, and I remember getting the Jay Glazer broke it on Twitter, and it was like, wow, they've traded for Jimmy Graham, and that was kind of exciting. And then with the Clowney one, I was actually in London doing a Luke Campbell fight. And I remember getting it, and I had to go to work, but I just wanted to write something about it immediately. I wrote a blog post on my phone. So that's how desperate I was to write about it. So, but I was excited. You know, what do you guys remember about those trades?
I was buzzing for both of them. I think I got a text from a mate in Seattle for the Jimmy Graham one. The Harvin one, I don't exactly remember. And then last year for Clowney, I think I was on the couch. I was about to go and cater a wedding, I think, just ready to go off. And all of a sudden, this news came down, and I nearly almost put the wedding on hold, but I don't think that was quite allowed by the bride and groom. But, you know, someone's got their priorities wrong, if you ask me. But I was buzzing, because ultimately, you know, we said last year the mantra was to have fun, and it was the most fun thing they could have done. They got rid of, like, a boring pick and a couple of boring players, much like you know, Hawk blogger wants to tell you how much Jacob Martin is an incredible player because, you know, everyone's got to have a take. It was just like so much fun. And I would do the same again. I would happily never pick in the first round. Like, for me, like, you look at some of these players, who's just gone for a... Which defensive back's just gone? AJ Bouye has gone for like a fourth round pick, I think, for Jacksonville. Now, for me, if that's what a fourth round pick's worth, trade them all for players. Like, you know, the draft isn't necessarily my thing. It's not something that I pour, you know, loads of resource in like you do, Rob. So I imagine you have a slightly different view. But, you know,
no, I agree with you 100%.
You know, if that's what a pick is worth, given, you know, I mean, how many fourth round picks have we had that have really come good versus what AJ Bouye could do in the backfield? Like, for me, it would be a no brainer. So I love the trades. I get really excited by it.
Yeah, I agree
with you 100%. And I do a draft blog, but I've always said players are more important than picks, and it's about having talent.
Yeah.
Now, if you draft talent that ends up becoming a great player, that's great.
That's the dream.
But the number of players who don't become great that you draft in the first and the second round far outweighs the players that become great. So if you can acquire really good players for your picks, do it. The chances are you'll be a better team.
Yeah, I think the common theme with both the Harvin one, I don't really remember the Harvin deal when we traded him away. I was working at a hotel with one of my mates from Carv in Jasper in Alberta in Canada, and he called me to the front desk and he goes, "You've got rid of Harvin." I was like, "What? Hey, what?"
We were going to see him 2 weeks later against Oakland. Yeah. And traded him away.
Yeah, but the common thing with the Jimmy and the Clowney ones was all the texts where she's saying swearing quite vigorously, and why are you allowed to have all the fun from fans of teams like the Falcons and Giants on my phone. That was like the main common theme with those two moves, because as you said, Rob, the Seahawks are quite often a circus, and it's going to be a pretty big circus, I think, next weekend, isn't it?
That's a great point, isn't it? I mean, how many other fan bases will have looked at the Seahawks throughout those three trades and thought, why can't we have as much fun as them? And it's often lost, I mean, amongst all the hand-wringing that goes on among Seahawks fans, you know, they're not playing the way that I want them to play. This isn't happening the way I want it to. This team hasn't won a Super Bowl, and I demand a Super Bowl. Even though so many players don't win. I mean, Drew Brees has only got one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Peyton Manning only got two because the Denver defense bailed him out. I mean, you guys could have played that Super Bowl.
Joe Thomas didn't play a playoff game.
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen Russell Wilson lift the Lombardi Trophy.
Yep.
And you know, actually, you kind of got to not take that for granted a little bit. As following this team for the last 10 years has been the most fun experience ever. Mm-hmm. And if they get one more title, that'll do me, quite frankly. Yep. You know, I want to see them win another one because, well, you know what's the alternative? You root for them not to win one. I want to see them win another one. I'll be content with that. I would be happy with that. If they don't do it, I'll be happy anyway, because it was just such a great experience.
Well, I always feel that the only thing I resent from 2014 to 2016, for the sake of argument, was that I didn't appreciate how good it was at the time, and you only start appreciating it once you're on the slide down. And you know, I made a vow last year to myself that if it was going to happen again, I'm going to just appreciate every minute of it, because you don't know when it's going to happen again. You know, Look at Kansas. You know, they're top of the mountain, but anything could happen with them, and it all goes wrong. I mean, I think I heard on a podcast Matt Money Smith last week saying, you know, there is no such thing as future planning in the NFL. Really, like, you just need to try and win next year. Don't worry about 2 years down the road because of the amount of things that can change and who can get injured and which coach might get fired or whatever. And that's why, for me, like, yeah, if you can get players for your draft picks, get them and have the most fun you can every week. Because, you know, I know it's a bit of a Pete Carrollism and Russell Wilsonism, but you can't really start looking much further ahead than what's in front of you, because the amount of things that change in the NFL is probably more than any other sport that we follow.
Yeah, I also think that as you get a bit older, your sort of perspective on life changes. I mean, like, you know, the Seahawks losing a close game when I was like 27 is a different feeling now that I'm pushing 36 and a dad of two. You know, it's like, you know, you're just too tired to give a crap after a couple of days. You know, you don't linger on the losses. You don't want everybody fired. You kind of just sort of, you know, you take it in your stride a little bit more. And I do think that sometimes, you know, the Twitter's very young. You know, it's a young thing, and I think a lot of the Seahawks fans on there, they're often sort of seen as a sort of collection of people that represent the entire fan base. I don't think that's accurate at all. And I think actually probably people, I reckon most Seahawks fans are probably very content with what they've had for 10 years. Of course you want a bit more, you always do. And hopefully they'll win a Super Bowl next season and we can all enjoy that. But I kind of think as time has gone on, I've kind of thought, yeah, do you know what? This is fun. This has been fun writing, talking, experiencing this team. And, you know, I'm never, you know, they will never forget that. You know, whatever happens between now and the end of the Carroll era, we'll always kind of have this time.
Yeah, but like, I was way more impacted by the away end at Southend a few weeks ago than what happened in whoever we lost to. I can't remember who we lost to in the playoffs this season.
Green Bay.
Just said Green Bay. I was way more reliving what happened in that away end at Southend a few weeks ago than I did what happened at Lambeau Field 6-7 weeks ago.
Yeah, but, yeah. I must admit, I probably took the Croatia semi-final loss for the World Cup in 2018 harder than any Seahawks playoff defeat in the last couple of years, because I've seen the Seahawks win a Super Bowl, and I've kind of come to terms. I came to terms with the other Super Bowl probably about 2 or 3 years ago, when the LOB era ended, and you kind of thought, now this cast of characters are not going to win one again together. Now you kind of hope that Carroll and Wilson and Wagner will, but there's been a little bit of a shift there.
Yeah.
But we've never seen England win anything at the football. So it's like, you know, it'd be nice to see that. You know, I've got tickets for the Euros for about 5 of England's games, and now I'm probably not going to get to see that because of coronavirus. So it's like, you know, it's just sod's law.
When you see a team VAR'd out of a Champions League final after 25 seconds in the most bent decision in sport history, you know, a loss to Green Bay, you kind of get over it when it's quite fun. Yeah. And Shaq Griffin makes you cry with a sack that is just amazing. So, yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm numb to any sporting loss after that. So it's all irrelevant for me.
Good call.
Very, very, very valid point.
I think it's time to go in the bin because I need to go to bed as well.
Okay. But quickly, just before we move on to the bin, one word answers, Rob and Adam, on the stay or go kind of thing. Clowney.
Stay.
Rob?
Yeah, I think he'll stay.
Is this what we think will happen or what we want to happen?
Will.
Will? Oh. Yeah. Oh.
Quick fire, Adam.
I'll go stay.
I don't think his market will be as hot as people are saying. And I think they'll get him for probably Frank Clark money.
Yeah, Jaron Reed.
Stay, and I think he'll sign quite a long-term deal because Seahawks will try and cash in on his weaker season last year.
Rob?
Yeah, I think Clowney, Reed, and one other for the D-line. I think that's what will happen in free agency, so stay.
So do you think Quinton Jefferson is going to be too rich for the blood?
Don't know. I think his stats and numbers look better than he actually is. So it'll be up to whether the league wants to give him a bit of money. I don't see the Seahawks paying much for him.
The Seahawks just circulate that video of him trying to jump in the crowd at Jacksonville, beating everyone up, and then hopefully no one touches him with a barge pole, and we can get him back to cheat.
He'll sign for the Jaguars.
Yeah, that would be great.
if Fede Britt and Iopati, obviously Britt isn't a free agent, but that seems to be a decision to be made. Do you think they'll keep all three? Continuity's been a bit of a touchy and sore point on the O-line the last few years.
Rob. I'll let you take that one, Rob.
I think Ifedi will go, Fant will go, Britt. It'll depend on his medicals. He's obviously doing his best. I think $10 million for Justin Britt's too much anyway. Yeah. But if they feel comfortable with his knee, they might extend his deal a year or two to lower that cap hit this year to free up a bit of space. If the knee is a problem, then they will cut him.
And Iopati?
Oh, good question, actually. I don't know. Because he had neck stingers, so you kind of think, does he want to play on? And, you know, he was banged up a bit. Do they feel they can rely on him? And then Phil Haynes played well, so I'm going to say go, but I could see him staying.
Yeah, I think he might walk away because of all that neck. Obviously, saw it with Cam and Cliff. Adam?
I'm not sure I could care less about any move the Seahawks ever made than whether Mike Iupati stays or goes. Like, I think if he had been on a heart monitor, I don't think it would even like change 1/10 of a heartbeat per second. Whether he's like, when I saw the tweet come in, I just
know that is the first thing that they do on Mondays. Mike, your party sends a 1-year deal stay in Seattle. I was going to send you a tweet straight away.
Like, I thought the guard play was generally a letdown last year, apart from Jamarco Jones. And so, you know, if they want to keep him for continuity's sake, fine. But I don't think I could care less. Apparently, George Fant is the highest rated left tackle under 30 on the market this year, which just shows how scarce that position is and kind of adds to why, if Efedi was financially viable, I would probably go ahead and do it. But that might be an unpopular view.
No, I agree. Rob?
I think the report from Tom Pelissero today was that Jermaine Efedi's in the 12 million a year range and that Fant's 10 million a year. Mm-hmm. I can't see them going 10 million for Fant. And if somebody does that, you know, they're banking on upside rather than anything he's shown as a starter. And then for Efedi, 12 million a year, I just can't see it. I think that they will back themselves. You know, the right tackle position, I think they have felt they can fill over the years. And they've had some success and some not so much success. So I think that they'll do what I said earlier, which is probably sign a draft hedge and then draft someone.
Yeah, so spinning a bit, Adam, seeing as you prompted us to move on to this, I'm going to throw to you first for your
For the first time ever, I planned one. And I just want to know, like, what is in the air in New Orleans that has made everyone go completely insane about Taysom Hill? Like, they obviously use him, for me, ridiculously too much. They're drinking the Kool-Aid on that. Then they put a first round tender on him, and apparently from reports that I read in the press this week, they actually think higher of him in the building than they say in public. I mean, the guy is like 31 years old and has thrown 19 passes, and they're talking about him as the number one quarterback going forward for the Saints. And maybe I'm missing something completely, but you know, there's a difference between a gadget player and someone that is worthy of, you know, the praise and hype that they seem to give him, and I just don't get it. Maybe I'm missing something, but I just find the whole thing completely bizarre. And it's like Peyton has, you know, we all do it with sports players, but we're fans. Like we pick up on someone and we just fall in love with them for no apparent reason, like Clint Dempsey at Spurs. But you know, it just seems completely bizarre to me.
Yeah, I agree. Teddy Bridgewater's leaving, and he's actually won games for that team more than just a bit of a Swiss Army knife that you can pull out once a week. It's very, very strange, but there's a lot of strange things about that franchise and whole organization, really. Rob, Taysom Hill?
Yeah, I agree again. I feel like I've agreed a lot with Adam.
That's happened once.
I think he's spot on again there. Look, he's a nice compliment to that offense, isn't he? And when he kind of trots out there, if he's playing your team, you kind of fear that he's going to do something, whether it's run, throw, catch, whatever. But there's a difference between that and, you know, leading an NFL team as a quarterback, starting quarterback. So, although to be fair, you know, the Saints as a fellow NFC contender, it would be quite nice if they were to suffer some form of a regression over the next few years to enable the Seahawks to just have a smoother passage. Hopefully the 49ers will do something stupid as well.
Well, I do wonder with the Saints if they're going to be, if you're a Saints fan, how delighted you would be just to see the same thing trotted out again this year. Because it's not really, you know, it's worked and they've come close, but Breeze has not looked up to it at the back end of the last two seasons, and I'm just wondering how delighted as a Saints fan you actually are that he's coming back for one more tilt at it.
Yeah, or you know, how thrilled you would be that you actually traded up for Marcus Davenport in the year that I think two other teams traded up from a similar range for Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes, and you had the chance to draft Lamar Jackson and you didn't. But at least you've got Marcus Davenport and his 3 sacks a season.
Yeah, that was, I mean, look, the Saints are kind of proving that almost that the salary cap is a myth, because they just keep playing players a hell of a lot of money and they don't, as you say, have the same year, season year on year. Anyone for the bin for you, Rob?
Just general misinformation, I would say. I'm not really giving this much thought, but I've kind of noticed over the last couple of weeks that there's a lot of stuff said to NFL fans that is not correct. So that throughout the combine, there was, that's a great time when a player who is like 235 pounds runs a 4.65. And, you know, you're thinking, well, that's not a great time for Zach Bourne, the Wisconsin. You know, you would want to see him run a lot faster than that. And the other thing was, this is more of a comedy thing. I'm not having a go at John Clayton. Would not do that. But he, yesterday on 710, he touted a 1.8 10-yard split for a speed rusher as a good time, when that is a slower time than many of the 350-pound offensive linemen were running. You know, 1.5 split would be really good for a pass rusher, but he said 1.8. But in the same breath, he also called Yeter Gross Matos. He called him Utah Gross Matost. So, maybe we'll let him off.
Yeah, I mean, there was some. I mean, Daniel Jeremiah seemed to say that after every 40, when the 40 they showed, they seemed to say it. That was a good time, and this just seemed to be slightly more.
They talked so much crap during that broadcast. I mean, it was one story after another, and then, oh, that's a good time. I mean, it was a little bit, you know, after the 23rd hour of watching it. But then again, it's a very difficult job. I mean, they were broadcasting for that long, so
yeah. And then at the back end of it, they try out Deion Sanders to shout at young cornerbacks for half an hour as well. I think, talking of their broadcast, my in the bin is Charlie Cassidy, because he seems to be there, the guy who starts their time, and he starts it with the strangest. I mean, it's like they don't even hold that stance in clay pigeon shooting. It's very, very, very strange. And he just, like, he's done nothing and contributed nothing of worth to that network and to anything, really, for the last few years. Some of his takes and, yeah, his mock drafts for mock draft's sake is, bad. So I think just for that, Charlie Cassidy can get in the bin, because that's just a very strange thing that everyone on social media picked up on.
Yeah, I mean, I've got one more, and it relates to the CBA that, you know, is clearly very complicated, and you can tell the polarization of salary in the NFL, where you've got the ones that are highly paid saying, look, don't do this because, you know, it's not going to safeguard our future. And the ones that aren't so highly paid, you can kind of understand saying, look, I can get 10% more of my salary if I sign this. But people like Ian Rappaport, I mean, we've called them out a couple of times before as just being mouthpieces for the league, but they really have shown themselves up a couple of times this year, you know, talking about how 250 grand for the 17th game is going to be a big step when Russell Wilson's already making like $2 million a game, basically. They've not shown themselves up particularly well, and I think it just adds to the idea that they're just too many people having to talk too much about the NFL, and it could probably do with a bit of time off, to be honest.
Yeah.
Can I just make one point on the CBA? I mean, to me, it just seems like a bunch of billionaires arguing with a bunch of millionaires about a bunch of money, and nobody seems to actually give a crap what the fans think. Mm. So no, fans don't want 17 games, but you're going to have it anyway. You know, if you ever see any polls about the 17th game, everyone always says no. You know, the league structure is fine. People don't want to see the playoffs changed. That's going to be changed. The combine being on it, nobody really asked for that, but you're going to get it anyway. They just seem to be ignoring the audience. And I just would be nice if somebody actually considered what the fans want for a change, rather than just how much more money owners can earn, and, you know, what kind of a portion they pass on to the people they employ. You know, the fans not matter? It just seems like, yeah, I don't know. No one seems to really care what they think.
But I think at the same time, the fans, I mean, you've seen it with all the fans always go against the players to a certain extent. They just kind of want to see the games. If the teams are shown to be pushing harder for that, and the players are pushing against the team's willingness, in inverted commas, to get games on and get this thing sorted for the next 10, 12, 15 years, however long this deal will last for. I think the fans will just kind of fall in line and just pay money no matter what, wouldn't they?
The fans are not going to abandon the league because of the 17th game. But I just find it amazing how the Premier League managed to constantly get more and more and more and more in TV deals and revenue without ever needing to incorporate like an extra couple of games here or there or completely change the structure of the league. And the NFL is such a worldwide thing, you know, it seems almost like a bit of an excuse just to earn a bit more for the owners and for the people running the league. And, you know, the league talks a lot about safety, but then says we're going to throw in an extra game. You know, there was a perfect symmetry about the NFL and I quite like the playoffs and the structure it has. And, you know, they're going to mess all that up now. And yeah, we'll all get used to it. And in a few years time, no one will think anything of it. Well, how, you know, even like the fact, who do you play in a 17th game?
It's going to mess everything up. Unless it's going to be like unless everyone's going to play internationally on the same weekend, I just cannot understand why on earth they would think that's a good idea, that 17th game. It's just bizarre, completely bizarre.
Yeah, but also that's kind of how the football over there is taken to VAR, isn't it, Adam?
I can't even listen to those three letters, Stuart. you've no idea how bad it is.
One more thing for the bit, because he's always in there, but I always like to mention the brilliant Twitter account back after this is just with Mike Francesca now retired and living off his Uncut Gems role. Colin Coward is front and centre for his Target, and last week Funhouse back after this brought up a tweet that Colin Coward talking about Jordan Love and how he was impressed when Alex Smith Rob defeated Nick Saban's Alabama, even though Alex Smith never faced Nick Saban nor Alabama in Utah, which kind of just shows how idiotic and consistently so Colin Coward is.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's much fun being Colin Coward. I mean, you have to come out every day and sound obnoxious and
does it quite well though.
Yeah, I know, but there must be some days when he gets into the office and just thinks, I can't be bothered to do this today. I just want to go out and talk about something really mundane, you know. And it's kind of like when you watch other football shows, they do kind of blend in that sort of the day-to-day sort of there's not much happening today kind of thing, whereas he'll come out and he'll wage a war against Aaron Rodgers or Baker Mayfield because it has to be ramped up to 11 all the time. So but, you know, he's made a living out of it, and fair play to him. He can be mildly entertaining sometimes.
Yeah. I'm led to believe that everything Cowherd says is scripted, even down to the pauses and the sighs. There are gaps in the script. I think I heard an interview with someone, I think it was Damashek, used to work for him on one of the shows, and he said that every single line he says is completely scripted, and it just, not that it's not rubbish anyway, but it just kind of adds to just the nonsensical. I mean, how many of those shows do we actually need?
There's a lot. That's all that's on TVs in America.
If you make the mistake of watching one of them on YouTube, though, then what happens is the algorithm just gives you every single one. So like every day I go on YouTube now and it's like, there's Coward, there's First Take, there's First Things First, there's Undisputed or whatever it is with Skip Bayless.
Skip.
You know, you've got just a never-ending stream of people talking about whatever the issue of the day is.
Yet they're all still miles better than Adrian Durham, which is quite good going for them to be
honest. Yeah. And I just wondered on the whole, if everything's scripted with Colin Coward, has anybody ever been tempted to do the old Anchorman trick? Yeah. You read literally everything that's on the auto cue.
That would be very, very good.
But, so Rob, obviously the next few weeks can be busy with articles and mocks and stuff on the draft blog. Where can people catch that? And it is going to be busy, isn't it, for you the next few weeks?
Yeah, you know, we've got kind of like an article every day. There's a great community on there, lots of different people, very active comment section. So join in. It's SeahawksDraftBlog.com. And we'll be doing it all the way through to the draft and then a couple of weeks after. And then I will be reintroducing myself to my wife and kids.
Yeah, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can on all your usual means and methods on Podbean, on Spotify, on the Facebook groups, and on the socials on Twitter as well. Adam, I think that is everything, isn't it?
Yeah, an hour and a half, not too bad.
Yeah, we're back in a couple of weeks with hopefully some pretty cool special guest. But until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks, I'm Clowney.